Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin as we head into what is expected to be the grimmest week so far. As the death toll from COVID-19 mounts and our ill-prepared healthcare system cracks under the strain of insufficient protective equipment for healthcare workers in crowded ICUs, which are expected to run out of life or death ventilators. Ironically, it is thanks to China, where the outbreak began as a result of an appetite for eating wild animals, and where the communist government's grip on secrecy allowed it to spread around the world, that our worst hotspot, New York, is getting 1,000 ventilators. And while it has always been clear that President Trump has made not just bad decisions, but ones that have invariably worsened the situation, and when he reluctantly does the right thing, it only happens after weeks of pleading from the few experts he listens to, and even then when he agrees to urge all Americans to wear face masks, he announced that he wouldn't wear one. And now we are learning that his arrogant dilettante of a son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been playing an equally destructive role behind the scenes, running a shadow crisis response team while sending the CDC and FEMA on whimsical, half-baked, dead-end missions, costing time and lives. Joining us to assess the damage is Paul Waldman, a columnist at the Washington Post Plumline, who is a senior writer at the American Prospect. We'll discuss his latest article at the Washington Post, "Trump's Ignorant Son-in-Law is Running the Coronavirus Response." That's unacceptable, and how Kushner and his coterie of entitled fraternity boys are impeding the flow of equipment by privatizing the supply chain, which has led to unnecessary delays and price gouging. At the same time, the administration is not employing the world's best disaster response network meant to deal with a national security crisis, the Pentagon's Defense Logistics Agency. Then we'll examine a glaring naked example of where Trump's true loyalties are as he stiffs the American people and those who voted for him while rewarding big business, in this case the multinational oil companies and shale oil frackers in Texas. By calling on Saudi Arabia and Russia to stop flooding the oil market and lowering the price of gas, Trump is violating a fundamental law of politics by raising the price of gas to hurt the American consumer at the pump during a recession. We will look into the pathetic silence from our political opposition and even those who oppose fracking, and speak with veteran energy expert David Freeman, who headed the TVA, New York Power, the LA Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar who rescued California from Enron and company. Then finally, we'll investigate why the Democrats are silent in the face of Trump's shafting of the American people and his outrageous declaration of war against the foundation of our democracy by insisting that there will only be in-person voting in November, meaning people will have to risk their lives to vote, and that every Democrat who shows up at the polls will have to show a photo ID. Robert Creamer, a longtime Democratic strategist and organizer and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, joins us to discuss the need for Democrats to unite and fight back against Trump's flagrant use of an unprecedented public health crisis to ensure his own re-election by foul means. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, who is a columnist at the Washington Post Plumline and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success, and his latest article at the Washington Post is Trump's Ignorant Son-in-Law is Running the Coronavirus Response. That's unacceptable. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Hi there, Ian.
Hi, and thanks for joining us, Paul. And I was very much struck by a tweet. Now, of course, tweets are what we are all sort of whipsawed by nowadays. Walter Shaub, the former director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics, just tweeted out, "I do not understand the federal government collecting taxes from us, using that money to buy medical supplies from the private sector, then giving the supplies to the private sector so the private sector can rip off states that have to purchase the supplies with more tax dollars. And what Walter Schaub is describing there, Paul, is exactly the system that the subject of your article, Jared Kushner, has set up. He apparently has got all of his fraternity brothers there working with him, and they're essentially telling FEMA what to do in a kind of shadow task force inside the White House. So let's start with that. Is this really what is happening, that he's just simply outsourcing this to the private sector instead of delivering stuff directly from the federal government to state governments?
It appears so. And this is one of the things that happens when you have people who don't actually have much experience in government come into government and think that the systems that have been established over years and decades just don't work very well, and they're smarter than everybody else who has done this before, and they can just come up with some new way to do it by calling up some of their friends. I think it's emblematic of the Trump administration in general, and particularly of someone like Jared Kushner, who, you know, it's interesting. We've all heard Donald Trump many times come out and declare that he knows more than the experts do about everything. You know, he says, I know more than the generals do about war. I know more than the scientists do about this disease. He's always saying how he knows more than people who actually have experience and training. And from the reporting that we've gotten from behind the scenes, it turns out that Jared Kushner thinks of himself the same way. He just says it in private and not in public. So he's been telling people that he understands things about public health and logistics that the people who do it for a living in government don't really know. And he can make this all work much better than the people who actually do it. And that's one of the problems. You know, you have a major crisis like this, and you have all these systems in place that are designed to enable the government to deal with it. And, you know, some of them have been neglected. Some of them have been undermined. But, you know, they're there waiting to be activated. And instead, apparently, Jared Kushner is running this kind of shadow operation that means that people within the government don't know where the lines of authority are. You know, there's an official task force led by Vice President Pence that's supposed to be coordinating things. And then somebody at FEMA, the emergency management agency, will get a call from somebody in Jared Kushner's office saying, we want you to do this instead. And they don't know who they're supposed to be accountable to. And, you know, we have to sort of remind ourselves of how appalling it is to begin with, that Jared Kushner is one of the most powerful people in government. He had no government experience. He basically has never had a job other than working in his family's real estate company. And he walks in and becomes one of the most powerful people in the federal government for no other reason than that he is the president's son-in-law. It's the kind of thing that happens in tin pot dictatorships. And yet, you know, after a while, we all just figured, well, okay, that's how it is. But now we're seeing, you know, after he was assigned to solve the opioid crisis and failed at that, and he was assigned to achieve Middle East peace and failed at that, every gigantic, difficult, challenging task, President Trump seems to give it to his son-in-law. And, you know, he's obviously not capable of this and is sort of taking over the functions that we have government systems that are established in order to administer. And, you know, it's not Jared Kushner's fault that we wasted so much time in really addressing this crisis. But he's certainly contributing to the difficulty we're having in addressing it in a way that can really lower the death toll and enable the economy to get back on its feet.
So, Paul Wollman, you mentioned the generals. General Honoré, famous for the competent response to the Katrina, he was in charge of that, and he was a breath of fresh air, just like Tony Fauci's a breath of fresh air now. He was asked just a couple of days ago about the appearance of Jared Kushner at the White House press briefings the other day, where he very arrogantly suggested that he knows more about who's competent and who's not, in terms of, he said that people get into politics, they should be competent, and a lot of the people at the state level aren't. Well, as though somehow the Trump administration was setting the example for competence, which is just a howler beyond belief. But back to General Honoré, he was asked about it on TV the other day, and he said Jared Kushner doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. But what Honoré went on to say, which I thought was very important, we all know that FEMA has been a dumping ground for political hacks and political favors, a patronage system. But the entire Pentagon hasn't really been tasked. And this is a national emergency. If this was ever an issue about national security, then what else is? And yet the Pentagon's not really dealing with it. And this, you know, corrupt and incompetent agency is now at the tip of the spear. So he was basically saying, if you really brought the Pentagon in with all of their talent, you'd have this situation under control in no time at all. Instead of working through this kind of political patronage dumping ground for Republican donors.
Yeah, there's something called the Defense Logistics Agency, where all they do is logistics. And they're one of the agencies that should be activated in a case like this, but really haven't been. And, you know, you've seen this kind of thing throughout the federal government. You know, there's an old saying that Republicans argue that government is incompetent and can't do anything right. And then when they take over the government, they set about to prove it. This is, I think, one of the stories of the Trump years that's less noticed than his own kind of personal, the show that he puts on every day, but is really tragic. And we're seeing it play out in cases like this where we really need them. You know, people might be familiar with Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk. What he did in that book was he just went around to some of the agencies that get less attention than many places, like the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Energy. And talking to people there, he found all kinds of incredibly committed, smart, competent professionals who did research and science and things like logistics that people don't really notice, but they're people who were doing their jobs and do their jobs through Republican and Democratic administrations. But once Donald Trump took over, there was a kind of contempt for everything that those people do. And he installed a bunch of kind of grifters and buffoons to be the political leadership of one agency after another. And then what you saw is a lot of those people found their work being undermined, found themselves being ignored, and a lot of them just decided to leave government, that they were fed up, even though they had, you know, they had, as I said, gone through Republican and Democratic administrations. And so you often find this kind of back and forth. You know, Democrats are the party that's more interested in and committed to government. And so when they come in, they do their best to take agencies like FEMA that, you know, you don't think about until you really need them, and to staff them with people who really know what they're doing and have a lot of experience. And then, you know, 4 years later, maybe a Republican gets elected, and then, you know, FEMA gets run by Michael Brown, who people might remember from Katrina, the heck of a job Brownie. Those kind of people who get put in place, and then when we absolutely need them, the agency has been, undermined and is a shell of what it once was, and then we have to suddenly try to get them to manage huge tasks that they're not going to be prepared for because they've lost funding, they've lost the people who are really good at their jobs, and they kind of have to scramble to try to address this new crisis. And I think that's what we're seeing now in a lot of the different agencies that are trying to handle this. And, you know, it's partly the public health problem, but also the economic problem, too. Like, here's another example. We just passed an enormous economic rescue package that had $350 billion of help for small businesses that has to basically be administered by the Small Business Administration. Well, this is by orders of magnitude bigger than anything the Small Business Administration has ever done before. They're a tiny agency with an operating budget of less than $1 billion, which in Washington is nothing. And they're widely known and have been for a long time as a place that is not particularly efficient or competent. And all of a sudden, we're now telling them that they've got to manage the passing out of a third of $1 trillion. And it's going to be a mess. You know, I spent much of last week talking to economists and budget experts about how this rescue was going to happen, what was missing from the bills, what ought to be done in the next bill. And every single person I talked to said to me, I am really worried about the SBA and whether they're going to be able to handle this task that they've been given. Now, That's something the SBA has had a bad reputation for a long time, even through the Obama years. But it's an example of how, you know, we have these agencies, and if we don't put the right people in them and give them the resources they need and make sure that they are running the way they're supposed to, when we really need them desperately, they're not going to be up to the task.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a columnist at the Washington Post's Plumb Line and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at the Washington Post is Trump's Ignorant Son-in-Law is Running the Coronavirus Response. That's Unacceptable. So earlier, Paul, you were talking about how extraordinary it is that this unqualified person whose only main qualification is that he married the president's daughter. And as you mentioned he screwed up his first appointment to deal with the opioid crisis. Actually, prior to that, his great contribution to Trump was that he was the one who urged Trump to fire Comey, which, of course, led to his impeachment. He also, of course, hasn't been in charge of Middle East peace, which is a joke because the Middle East peace deal was actually done by Netanyahu. It wasn't the Kushner deal. It was a Netanyahu deal all along. And then when this COVID pandemic hit, the first thing he said was he blamed the press for whipping up hysteria. And now, of course, he's the shadow task force running it behind the scenes. And obviously the other task force led by Vice President Pence have to be really annoyed by this whole situation. But Pence, of course, has an unlimited amount of humiliation that he apparently is prepared to accept. But from day one, my understanding is what happened when the Trump family business and the Kushner family business got elected, if you can call it that, they essentially treated the U.S. government as an acquisition. And it's worth noting that Steve Bannon, the early strategist of this White House, referred to Jared and Ivanka as a pair of grifters. And my understanding is what Jared essentially did from day one, even during the transition and before, after they got elected, again, I use that word advisedly, he basically hung up a shingle and let every crook and dictator and grifter around the world know that if you wanted to do any business with President Trump, you have to go through him. And that's the source of his power. But that's only happening because Trump allows it. So is it possible, Paul Waldman, that in effect what's going on here is what goes on in third world banana republics? Like, for example, when Salinas was president of Mexico, his brother was the bag man. So is it possible that Jared Kushner is Trump's bag man?
I think there are certain ways in which you can make those analogies. Now, obviously, here in the United States, we have a whole system of laws and institutions that are designed to help make that difficult. And it is more difficult. It's not the case that you can just give the president's son-in-law a briefcase full of cash. So they have to find ways around it. But I think from the beginning, one of the things that Trump has been very aggressive about is breaking down those systems and those laws and trying to find ways that that he can just make sure that the rules don't apply to him. So, we had this thing called the Emoluments Clause, which for 200 years nobody ever paid attention to because the idea that the president would be trying to make money while he was in the presidency was absurd. Barack Obama wouldn't refinance his mortgage when rates went down because he was so worried about the appearance of any kind of impropriety. And that was the norm for over two centuries. And Trump just came in and said, well, I don't care. And so then he was able to mobilize his own, whole network of officials and people who will try to defend him and make sure that he isn't held accountable. So, he's hiding his tax returns and has been from the beginning. Without everyone, Democrat and Republican, seems to agree that if they were revealed, it would be a disaster because who knows what's in them. And so you have, everybody from the Treasury Secretary on down working hard to make sure that those never see the light of day and, using the courts and kind of novel and fantastical interpretations of existing law to make sure that he doesn't have to show those returns. And we've seen that kind of over and over and over again. And so Trump spends, you know, at least something like one out of every 3 days of his presidency at one of his properties. And when he goes there, the Secret Service has to rent golf carts from him and rent rooms at inflated prices. And so, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars end up flowing into his pockets. And then you have a whole system where it becomes immediately known that if you want something from the president, what you have to do is put money in his pocket. And so you have to go to his hotel and rent a suite of rooms and make sure that he knows that you're doing that. And you have to, you know, every Republican organization, they all book, you know, meeting rooms at his hotels for their events. They know that it's like in the mafia. You have to kick up to the boss. That's how the system works. And when it comes to Jared Kushner, you know, people, representatives from these other governments know that as the president's son-in-law, as you say, just in any banana republic, he's a conduit to the boss. And so you can help him out. And there's this whole, you know, complicated story, for instance, with this property at 666 Fifth Avenue that Jared Kushner bought. And it was an absolute disaster. It almost destroyed his family's real estate company. He bought it at the height of the market for a hugely inflated price before the crash of 2008, and it became this albatross of debt around the Kushner company's neck, and they tried to get rid of it and tried to renegotiate their loans, and it went on for years and years, and it threatened to destroy the company. And eventually, once Donald Trump got elected, through you know, he ended up getting saved by this sort of multi-layered network of banks and people that involved the government of Qatar, I think. And eventually some, you know, a group of foreign institutions kind of came in and basically saved the Kushner company's bacon by giving them what was essentially a bailout for this office building in New York. And you can bet they did that not because it was a good investment and not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because this was a way to gain the favor of the Trump administration. And, you know, as people from authoritarian dictatorships, they know how this works. So if you want to, you know, if you want to save the president's son-in-law's family company, that's going to do you very well when you come back and ask for favors from the administration. And so, you know, there's just this kind of very broad and universal understanding that the rules have changed in Washington now. And the way you get things from this president is that you have to give him personally money. You have to help out his family. And that's the currency. And if you don't do that, you're going to become an enemy. And the, you know, the very idea that there's some kind of public good that ought to be pursued that stands above his own personal interests is just kind of a memory. And nobody even pretends that that's the case anymore. So, you know, the specifics of whether or not Kushner is involved in one corrupt deal or another, you know, those things can take a long time to unearth. But what we unquestionably now have is a much more deeply corrupt system than we've had in a long time. And, you know, this gets to something I think that a lot of people misunderstand. When it comes to corruption, I think there's a general perception that it always gets worse. But the truth is that in many ways, up until 2016, we were less corrupt as a system than we had been ever before. That the kind of naked, you know, I'm going to give you $100,000 and you are going to change your vote on that bill, Mr. Congressman, that kind of stuff is much less common than it used to be. It still happens every once in a while. But it's much less common than it was 100 years ago or maybe even 50 years ago. We have more oversight now. We have new rules in place. We have a media that's much bigger and sees a lot more. And because of, you know, electronic filings, we can see these things much more quickly. You know, so for instance, what we just saw with Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler, she apparently did a bunch of stock trades. After being told, getting briefings about the coronavirus and what was coming, she sold a bunch of stock in companies that might go down, and she bought stock in, for instance, a company that does teleconferencing, and it all looks extremely suspicious. She says that she didn't have control over those trades and basically wasn't her fault. We'll see if that, you know, what the full truth ends up being. But the reason we know that is that a few years ago they passed a law that said that congressmen and senators had to report all of their stock trades. And so now we can see very quickly if something like that happens. So we have these systems in place that make things less corrupt, but we now have an administration that has basically done everything in its power to allow itself to be as corrupt as it wants to be, despite all of those rules and all those institutions that are supposed to keep it from happening.
Just in the last couple of minutes, and by the way, neither Donald Trump nor Jared Kushner, well, we know Jared Kushner couldn't get his security clearance there for a while, and Trump would never qualify for a security clearance under any, because of his relationship to the Russians. But in Jared's case, one of the problems that the intelligence community had with him is that his relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, this Saudi crown prince, was such that he even gave MBS information about Saudi dissidents. And one of them, of course, who worked for the same newspaper you write for, Paul Wollman, Shoji, was murdered by MBS. But a part of the deal was that they basically encouraged MBS to do the blockade, or gave him permission to do the blockade against Qatar. And then what they did was they used their leverage that they have basically to tell the Qataris that, you know, if you want to, you know, get back in our favor, then maybe you should lend some money to Jared. That's my understanding of what happened. But just in the last minute, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the broader sense in terms of the Democratic opposition. For the life of me, I don't understand why the Democrats are not saying a word about the fact that Donald Trump violated one of the cardinal rules of American politics, which is no politician ever asked to raise the price of oil on the American consumer, because who wants to pay more at the pump? But that's exactly what Trump did on Thursday and met with the oil company executives on Friday. So for some reason or other, there's not an outcry from the Democrats or even the public that Trump is trying to raise the price of oil on the American consumer during a recession. That ought to be political suicide, but it's not. And then Trump is also saying that the elections are going to have to be conducted in person. He won't allow vote by mail, and he's insisting that everybody has to show up with a photo ID in order to vote. So it's pretty clear where he's heading. And again, he's not just attacking the Democrats, he's attacking American democracy itself. Where is the outrage?
Well, Democrats are never very good at that kind of opportunistic, you know, picking up the bludgeon that their opponent has laid in front of them. Now, you can say that the oil situation is very complicated because, you know, on the one hand, when prices at the pump are going down, but on the other hand, there's an oil industry in the United States that is greatly threatened by the fact that prices have dropped so much. I think that as an issue right now, it may not be as potent as it usually is because nobody's driving. And so, you know, if you when you go out just to go, you know, from your house to the supermarket, you may notice that your local gas station, it's only $1.80 a gallon. And you think, oh, that's great. It would be great if I actually needed to get any gas, but I don't. So that may have something to do with, you know, people thinking maybe it's not so urgent. But it is extraordinary. You're absolutely right to see the president come out and say, we need higher gas prices. And if the Democrats decided to that, you know, despite the whatever the effects will be on the American fossil fuel industry, that they could just go out and spend a couple of days bashing him about that, it probably would be effective. But they don't. You know, Democrats spend a lot of time worrying about how being too tough on Republicans will make them look. And it's something that Republicans never worry about. You know, they never say, oh, we've already done 7 Benghazi investigations. Should we go ahead and do an 8th one? Perhaps people will think that's overkill. That doesn't occur to them. They just keep doing it. They just keep hitting and hitting and hitting. And Democrats are always worried that they will look like they're being too partisan, or that, you know, they're being too mean to their opponents, and people might not like that. And they live in fear of a sternly worded editorial from the New York Times or the Washington Post. Republicans don't. They don't care. They just know that it's good to constantly hit against Democrats. And so that's what they do. And it's often very effective.
Well, Paul Wollman, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Wollman, who's a columnist at the Washington Post Plumline and a senior writer at the American Prospect. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at the Washington Post is Trump's Ignorant Son-in-Law is Running the Coronavirus Response. That's unacceptable. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining a glaring naked example of where Trump's true loyalties are.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my youth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of John Fitzgerald Kennedy and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the California State Energy Czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. He is the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and a Hopeful Future, and he has an autobiography, The Green Cowboy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, it's good to be back, although it's a new world that we face now since the last time we talked.
Well, indeed, Dave, and it's also a new world politically, because the president violated one of the norms of American politics, which is no politician in his right mind would want to raise the price of oil and hurt the American consumer at the pump, particularly during a recession, which is what we have now. Yet on Thursday, Trump tweeted out that he was going to work with Saudi Arabia and Russia to have them stop flooding the market, which is lowering the price of oil down to $20 a barrel. The market did spike, went up to $25 a barrel. And then on Friday, the president met with all the top oil executives from Exxon and Chevron, etc., to try and, again, work on a plan to raise the price of oil. And obviously, there are electoral considerations. He's worried about losing Texas. But how does it strike you as somebody with a long, long perspective on energy and oil in this country, and particularly how it affects the White House?
We don't use curse words on this program, but it is unbelievable. It's absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, I can remember being a staff person for the Senate Commerce Committee in back in the 70s, and I remember once I had a breakfast meeting one-on-one with Senator Mondale, and I mentioned something about, you know, for energy efficiency purposes, maybe we ought to raise the price of oil. And he almost jumped out of his chair and leaned over the table and looked at me and he says, "Dave, I just want you to get something through your thick head once and for all. I will never, never vote to raise the price of oil. I'd rather let the oil companies raise the price and then I'll criticize them." It was just a kind of a fundamental of American politics that the president would call the head of Saudi Arabia and urge him to pump more oil to try to bring the price down. That was kind of our unwritten relationship with Saudi Arabia for 50 years, I think, where we helped them remain a country with armaments and everything else, and we sort of guaranteed their existence, and they were supposedly the consumer protector against OPEC in the sense that not engaged in jacking up the price of oil. Here, the president of the United States, does something that the oil company lobbyists could never do. He occupies the Oval Office. And as president, he lobbies Saudi Arabia to violate the marketplace and to engage in the cartel type activities that we fought all these years. And what I tell you what really troubles me, and that is that the ordinary press, I read the Washington Post on Friday, they treat this as almost a good thing. I mean, if you read the article, the price of oil has gone up, things are looking better in Texas. I mean, I just have the feeling that my world of energy is turned upside down. And then, where are the environmentalists? I mean, this is kind of like manna from heaven. We're going to eliminate fracking because it's uneconomic. And the President of the United States says, no, we can't eliminate fracking. We've got to keep fracking. And I've heard no peep out of anybody from the environmental movement pointing out that this is just crazy. This is a horrible situation that we're in right now, and we have to take it one day at a time. What could come out of this is that people are learning that they can do things remotely in part. And the point about it is everything is up for grabs, but certainly the possibility of finally getting those investments in the future into solar and wind and not into oil is a very real possibility. And oops, the President of the United States says, oh no, we got to keep fracking it, no matter how much it costs, at the expense of the consumer. And I don't see strong reaction like the conversation you and I are having right now coming out of the press.
Well, what about the political opposition, the Democratic Party? Why are they silent?
Well, they're I can't answer that question because there isn't a good answer. I mean, we're Democrats. We're not a political party.
Okay. And again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter, and headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. And he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. And he has an autobiography, The Green Cowboy. So on Thursday, as I mentioned, President tweeted out that he wanted the Saudis and the Russians to stop their oil war and stop flooding the market, which is lowering the price of gas, of oil, down to $20 a barrel. It's the only silver lining, frankly, in this otherwise bleak picture of people being shut at home and losing their jobs by the millions. At least the one thing we can say is that gas is cheap and nobody's really driving and the air is cleaner. It's just manifestly clear. But the one thing that he also tweeted out on Thursday was that Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto head of Saudi Arabia, had spoken with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. But then no sooner had Trump said that than Dmitry Peskov, Putin's spokesman, said no such conversation took place. So you wonder about the basic competence or even the mental state of this president. He just seems to make stuff up.
Well, yes, but I think the story here, though, is that this is obviously the most transparent president we've ever had. I mean, he not only admitted, but he bragged about what he did. The fact that it may not be effective, maybe the saving grace, but the story here is that public this president has just turned a fundamental policy of the American government upside down. I mean, Republicans, Democrats, independents, there was one thing we agreed on, is that we wanted to keep the price of gasoline lower, not higher. And of course, the impact on the American economy, I mean, you say nobody's driving, but the truth of the matter is that in March, the numbers show that the gasoline consumption was down. Say it's down 15, 20%. That's still a huge amount of money being spent on gasoline, and the fact that it has gone down at a time when people are hurting is a boon to the economy, I think, on balance. I mean, he's saying it's more important to keep a few fracking jobs going in Texas than saving most of the American people a dollar a gallon on their gasoline bill. And there's just a lot of gasoline still being bought. And it's all not just gasoline, it's heating oil and all the products of oil. So, you know, we do. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, when he became president, he went out of his way to prove that he was a consumer's man and didn't favor the Texans. This guy, who's a New Yorker, is going out of his way to prove that he favors the Texans over the people in New York.
Well, of course, the people in New York are really suffering from the coronavirus pandemic, and the president and his team, his administration, have essentially cut them loose, and they're on their own. Which is an amazing situation to see, and the worst is about to happen. So it is a shocking situation where there is obviously something going on in this country where he favors certain states and certain governors, and some governors haven't even shut down their states, and we don't know whether he's sending more equipment to red states and starving blue states. But we do know that he's concerned about winning Texas. And again, this seems to be what motivates this president. He has to get elected, and he doesn't want to go to jail. So at the end of the day, isn't this what this is all about? It's pretty transparent that he basically...
Well, you know, I decided a long time ago that I try to stick to my field. I know a little bit about energy. About the workings of Donald Trump's mind, I know nothing.
Well, it's probably better that you...
I mean, seriously, I think trying to figure out what makes that guy tick is up to someone else. All I'm saying is what he's doing is just upside down of anything that American energy policy has done in my lifetime. I mean, there are a lot of issues that are controversial. I mean, some people are for, say, a carbon tax. Some people are not. I mean, there are issues where it's rational to have two sides. But on whether you're for a higher or lower price of gasoline and heating oil, it's never been an issue. It's always that the president is on the side of the consumer. Every once in a while, something happens that is just so fundamentally different than common sense and reality that it does make you wonder. It does make you wonder. But we have a crisis on our hands that's kind of bigger than the both of us in terms of the virus. But it's just fascinating to me that in the middle of all this, we have the President of the United States from the Oval Office actually lobbying Saudi Arabia to do exactly the opposite of what we've been trying to get them to do for ever since Franklin Roosevelt met with King Saud right at the end of World War II. I mean, this is one of the few stables, I'd say, one of the few really anchors of American policy Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is based on a mutuality of understanding that we will protect them as a nation, but when push comes to shove, they're there to pump oil and try to keep the price as low as reasonably possible, not cooperate with the other OPEC members in trying to raise the price higher. You would think that a Republican president in favor of free market principles would have the sensitivity not to get on the side of a cartel and do the opposite of what the marketplace is doing. He and would applaud the fact that the free market is finally bringing the price of oil down to a competitive level. And, you know, if you look at the oil bill of the American people and you knock off $10 a barrel, it is a big number. I don't have it in my head. But it could stimulate the economy at a time when we are in a recession. But I don't think any of that really registers with the current administration. Apparently it doesn't. If it does, then they're not paying any attention.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Dave Freeman, it's obvious that, as we mentioned before, that the opposition, the Democratic Party, is being silent on this. But also the American people. The outrage that should be expressed, I don't see it. Maybe people are distracted by this enormous crisis on their hands.
I think people are distracted. And the reason you and I are talking is that people generally are very much concerned about the virus and are not paying attention. And that's understandable. But you would think that the press generally would be sounding an alarm here, but the so-called where are the modern day Ralph Naders is my question. Where are the modern day environmental leaders? I hear nothing from the consumer movement or the environmental movement. Here, from an environmental point of view, is finally the makings of something that could show that we could live with a whole lot less oil and a whole lot less pollution and lower at the same time that we're putting the fracking business out of this. I mean, all of these folks that have spent so much time opposing fracking, where are they? That's my question.
Well, it's a question that needs to be answered. But just in closing, Dave Freeman, if the president can get away with violating the laws of politics by raising the price of oil and hurting the consumer at the pump, which no prior president has ever wanted to do, they've always wanted to do the opposite, as you have pointed out. So that is in itself pretty extraordinary. But the president also just tweeted out that he does not want this November election, which many people feel will be happening under the coronavirus pandemic strictures. He doesn't want people to be able to vote by mail. He's insisting that you have to do in-person voting, no matter how much of a risk that is to the voter's health. And he's also added that people should only be able to vote if they have a photo ID. So he's doubling down on trying to stop the next election, at least in terms of making it much more open. And the naked partisanship of this is pretty shocking. So if he can get away with raising the price of gas at the pump and people aren't outraged, do you think they're going to be outraged when he decides that he wants to do the election his way, not the Democratic way?
I think our democracy depends on the answer. And I'm not savvy enough to know the answer, but I think the question has to be asked, and you're asking it. And I think if enough people ask the question, we might get the right answer. But right now, we're pretty much AWOL on this issue, aren't we?
Well, David Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, hopefully next time we talk, we'll have better news.
I surely hope so. And thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of John Fitzgerald Kennedy and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from Enron and Company. And he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. And he has an autobiography, The Green Cowboy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's declaration of war against the foundation of our democracy by insisting that there will only be in-person voting in November, meaning people will have to risk their lives to vote, and that every Democrat who shows up to vote will have to show a photo ID.
I've been waiting for years to buy a brand new Cadillac, but now that I've got one, gotta send it right back. I can't afford the gas for my brand new limousine.
Step right up, following the leader.
Follow the leader, I can't sing. Follow the leader, I can't sing.
A verified freestyle, lyrics of fury. My third eye make me shine like jury. You're just a renter rapping, your rhymes are minute made. I'll be here when it fade, I watch it flip like a renegade. I can't wait to break and eliminate on every trade of a snake, so stay awake and follow, because the tempo's a trail. The stage is a cage, the mic is a third rail. I'm Rakim.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Creamer, who's a longtime Democratic strategist and political organizer and the author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He's a partner in Democracy Partners. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks. And our previous guest was talking about how amazing it is that Donald Trump seems to be getting away with the idea that he's actually raising the price of gas, which is no politician's ever wanted to do that. Right. In American political history, as far as I can tell, and yet he's doing it, and there isn't an outcry. So what's happening, or what's not happening here?
Well, I think the principal reason that it has essentially gone under the radar is that everything is consumed by the COVID-19 crisis, and that's what's on all the news, and that's what's on everybody's mind, because it directly affects everyone, both economically and of course, from a standpoint of their own health and their ability to socialize and move around. And, you know, there are very few things in American political history that have been so all-consuming as this crisis, at least recently. So that's number one. I think that's the big one. In addition to that, we did start, you know, with oil prices, or at least gas prices, kind of low relative to America's recent experience of memory. But you're absolutely right that there is no precedent for a politician or a political leader wanting to run up oil prices. And I would say there are a couple of reasons. I mean, it's another example of Trump, paying closer attention to the interest of his fossil fuel friends and his executive buddies who really do care about this because, frankly, oil prices had dropped to levels where it was no longer economic for them to produce a lot of things like a lot more fossil fuels, particularly through fracking. And, you know, they're some of his closest allies. And the other thing is, I think he's very concerned that, about the stock market as an indication of everything in the economy. And, of course, because that's the kind of thing he cares about. And the stock market is responsive to oil prices go down substantially. It'll drive down stock prices as well. And so overall, he was trying to assure the markets, among other things, when he said that, I think, and try and drive stock prices up in the financial markets.
And also, he's obviously thinking about Texas, where there'd be unemployment because of the frack is going out of business. But just in the last few minutes here, because we're running short of time today, unfortunately, the other thing that he's doing, though, he's saying that the in the November elections, there will be no absentee voting, voting by mail, that people have to show up. There has to be in-person voting. And furthermore, he added that they have to show a voter ID. And of course, he can't, he's not in charge of the elections because they're done at the state level. But that, to me, is a scary portent. What are the Democrats going to do about this?
Well, for one thing, the next phase of stimulus or coronavirus response, I think, in the Congress will be a bill that not only expands a number of the things that were just passed, many of which were quite good, some of which were not as good, but really addresses this question of mail balloting. It's absolute madness not to invest in the infrastructure for mail balloting and allow for require essentially that every American has the ability to do that if he or she wishes to. We don't know what the situation is going to be in November here. We certainly ought to be prepared. Of course, that's not been the hallmark of their whole overall approach to this coronavirus outbreak, being prepared. We ought to be prepared to assure that the elections can go forward, even in a context like the one today, which we hope we will not have, but which is we should be prepared for. And so I think the Congress is going to, that is the House, will do its best to press this issue. And we need to organize in every state to assure that state legislators and governors step up on this question, because mail balloting is a critical element in making sure we have a fair and honest election this fall.
So let's turn to the broader issue of what's happening in the asymmetry between Trump being able to use these daily White House briefings as political rallies and the silence coming from Joe Biden. And to be fair to Biden, of course, he's hamstrung because Bernie Sanders hasn't conceded, so he can't really say, I'm the leader of the opposition here. But we desperately need an alternative narrative to the nonsense and the dangerous nonsense coming from Trump. So is there a way out of this?
Well, right now, a lot of that, of course, is coming from Nancy Pelosi. It's coming from Democratic governors. It's coming from Chuck Schumer. But, you know, and Biden, as you say, is also hamstrung by the fact that he's not really a player in this drama, except from the sidelines, whereas these others, including the president, of course, are. But I do think that the campaign is the Biden campaign and are thinking about ways they can assure that he is more fully inserted into the narrative, which I think would be a very good thing. I got to say, I'm so proud of the Democratic governors around the country. J.B. Pritzker in Illinois and Cuomo in New York and John Bel Edwards in Louisiana. A lot of these guys, your governor out there in California, have stepped up in a serious way. Same is true with Governor Inslee in Washington. I mean, they've provided the leadership, I think, that are examples, exemplars of what true leadership is. And such contradiction or contrast to Trump. By the way, his numbers, you know, the way he's handled the crisis, I just saw a recent poll this morning. Numbers have dropped a lot just in the last week in terms of his favorables with respect to handling this crisis, and for good reason. I mean, right. Lord have mercy, the guy was not prepared at all. Totally asleep at the switch.
Well, it's worse than that. Worse than that, Bob. He actually actively resisted doing things that should have been done. And he only did things grudgingly and belatedly. And even the latest one where Fauci says we all should wear face masks, Trump says, well, I'm not going to wear a face mask.
I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is a guy, little spoiled brat.
In contradiction to, I mean, you think about that picture of Harry Truman with that thing on his desk that says the buck stops here. Right. You know, in his case, it's the buck stops anywhere but here. He won't take responsibility for anything. Unbelievable.
Well, let's just end up where you mentioned Governor Cuomo. He's become quite a star. People are talking about why can't we draft him as the presidential candidate. What do you think
of
that?
Well, he's doing a good job, but I think there's very little question that it is that Joe Biden will be the nominee. I mean, he has substantially more delegates than anyone else, and is on track to be over the top of the 1,900 delegates needed in the Democratic Convention, whenever and however that might occur. So I think it'll be an academic question. I'm very hopeful that Joe Biden will appoint somebody to run for vice president, by the way, with him, who is very inspirational to a lot of the folks who he needs to attract from Bernie Sanders' base and from Elizabeth Warren's base. You know, those folks have to vote this time. But I got to tell you, I think most Americans are going to step up and say, you know, time has come and we need a bold new direction and we need to do everything we can to rid this country of this president.
Well, to get people from Elizabeth Warren's base, why not have Elizabeth Warren herself?
She'd certainly be a great candidate. I mean, but there will be others. He's made it real clear he's going to appoint a woman. I think that's a great thing because I think women will save us in this election. And there are a number of qualified candidates. Elizabeth certainly would be. She was always my favorite for the nomination. I'm a huge Elizabeth Warren fan. I think she's one of the most capable political leaders we have in America.
Well, Robert Creamer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, and I look forward to talking with you throughout this cycle. I do think Joe Biden is going to be the candidate, and I think Joe Biden will lead us to victory in this fall, and we're going to do everything we can to help make that possible. I hope everybody on your listeners will, too. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Creamer, who is a longtime Democratic strategist and political organizer, and he's the author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, and he's a partner in Democracy Partners. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. The headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.